From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We all know the actors who try and make their performances real or naturalistic. Daniel Day-Lewis is one who tries to embody a role on screen and off. And the critic David Thompson gets it. Sometimes that process works. But in his new book, Thompson says when you're talking about acting, any attempt at realism is self-defeating. Because this is acting. And acting, he says, is always and always has been an escape from reality. Sometimes our reality is boring or depressing or horrible. Acting, he says, is a retaliation. Thompson's book is an extended essay about why acting matters, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Acting is an entertainment for sure, but he says it's also a model for our existence and collapse. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Yale University Press has a series of books called Why X Matters, Why Architecture Matters, Why the Constitution Matters, Why Niebuhr Matters. And they asked David Thompson to explain why acting matters. Thompson is a highly respected critic and writer. His book, The Biographical Dictionary of Film, is seen as a classic reference on movies. As a rule, Thompson says, we humans tend to make a mess of reality. Not only our lives at times, but just look at global warming, for example. And so he says we look to fertile fictional places in plays and film. The purpose of acting, he says, is to evade reality for a time. This is how he puts it in his essay. Acting is, as he says, our dying attempt to believe that life is simply not a desperate, terrifying process in which we are alone and insignificant. David Thompson is joining us today to talk about why acting matters. You can join us too. If you act or observe acting and have your own impressions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Thompson, I mentioned the Biographical Dictionary of Film. It's actually the new Biographical Dictionary of Film. He updated it a few years ago. He also has biographies of Warren Beatty, Orson Welles, David O. Selznick. He's joining us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco, where he's based. And David Thompson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So I guess I wanted to know, when Yale University Press first approached you to write this book, did you know right away what you wanted to say about acting?
No. I only knew that I thought it was a golden opportunity because I had been writing about performance in one way or another for 50 years.
Right.
But I'd never stepped back and thought about the whole thing. And I knew that I was fascinated by it. I'm one of those people who believes that actually most people go to the movies and go to see a play because they just want to see human beings act for them. I'm one of them. I know professionally that films are made by directors or auteurs, and playwrights write the plays. But I think the contact, the real warm emotional contact, is us watching people pretend for our pleasure.
Mm. It's interesting because you say that the more real, quote-unquote, plays are, the more real, quote-unquote, movies are, the quicker you become bored. Why? Because you like the conceit of, look, let's not pretend this is real. This is, I like that you're pretending.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think that very often a strenuous attempt to be realistic, for it to be a slice of life, can become ponderous, can become boring. Mm. Because I think we all know that what we're seeing is an act of pretending. So the further fields of the imagination and fantasy and wondering are often the most interesting. So, for instance, we like horror films. It's not because we think going out on the street every day we're going to meet Frankenstein's monster. But when we do meet him, it crystallizes a lot of our fears of the unknown and of aliens. So that in all art, I think, there is this stepping beyond reality and the lifelike into a deeper imaginative level.
There's a novel you write about in the book by Walker Percy called The Moviegoer,
yes.
Which I wanted to ask you about this because it really helps you explain where this idea of acting fits in our culture. And it's about this kind of ordinary fellow who goes to movies all the time to escape, you know, humdrum life. And there's this moment where he sees the actor, William Holden, on the street, and he's like a ghost. Would you talk about this part?
Well, it's a brilliant passage in a very good novel. And what's magical about it is that you're never quite sure whether the character on the streets of New Orleans has actually seen the William Holden.
Right.
Or has he indeed seen someone pretending to be William Holden or a ghost? And you know, sometimes that happens to us all. We see someone who we ask ourselves, is that so-and-so? And he sort of tests the question by noticing that this man has a lot of the very casual mannerisms that William Holden has. And, of course, that leads to a very interesting point, because before the movies, acting was speaking the speech.
Right.
It was playing the character. The movies changed acting in the most remarkable way, because suddenly there was a place for people who probably could not have gone on stage. They couldn't be heard. Yeah. They might not be able to remember all the lines. But on film, they can just exist. And if they are, let's say, photogenic, if they're charismatic, if they have charm, if they're Gary Cooper or William Holden,
right,
we are drawn in. There is something about them. It's the thing that lets some people work in movies and others don't.
You called Holden's sense of this an empty splendor waiting to be
in
film.
I mean, because there is something about that in William Holden.
Yeah.
And because he ended up playing roles that really were quite different from stage roles. I think what the movies have done to acting is to make us begin to realize that we are acting all the time, because we are trying to have people understand us. And we use hand gestures, and we use an incredible range of facial gesture, which we've learned through life by looking in the mirror, but by watching other people and by watching actors in close-up on screen.
It's interesting because in the book you kind of imagine how the first acting may have happened in human history, that moment, as you put it in the book, when instead of just being themselves, they presented those selves with a sort of purpose.
Yeah. Well, I sort of invent a moment way back in time where a Stone Age man, a man who lives in a cave, is out one day hunting for his family. And he gets involved with a lion. And he has a huge fight with the lion. And he's torn and wounded and he's bleeding. But he manages to kill the lion. And he then hurries back to the cave. And something happens in his mind where he says, well, what shall I tell them? I don't want to alarm them too much and make them afraid of going out. But equally, I thought I did a pretty good job with the lion. So you begin to decide what you're going to say and how you're going to persuade people of what happened. It's exactly like a child who goes to school, comes home. The parents say, well, what happened today? And in a way, the kid can't remember because it was absolutely mundane. In a way, he hates having to explain it and tell a dull story. But he realizes that his parents love him, and they need to know, they need to hear from him. So he forms a way of beginning to persuade them. We all do it with the people close to us, the people we live with. If we stop a stranger on the street to ask directions, we want to impress them that we're serious and sober. We're not going to attack them. All of those situations involve us presenting ourselves. And that is a form of acting.
You know what's so interesting about that? If you think about just how we evolved as creatures, that self-awareness, in some sense, acting makes us human. Because once we start to think about our condition enough to pretend, we have consciousness.
Yes. I mean, I think once reality deepens and takes on self-awareness and memory and the need to persuade people of what has happened to you, to be liked, you know, because time and again when we talk to someone, we really deep down want them to like us. And we understand that to be likable, we have to do certain things with ourselves. We have to speak clearly, or we have to speak sincerely. We have to look at them. We have to look at them in the eye. We have to smile sometimes. And I don't mean that a kind of duplicity enters into our lives, but it is a double level. And I think all of us by now, after 130 years of the movies, whatever, I think we're all aware of that. And it is a very complicated process in our heads that we're turning into gestures, smiles, the way we speak, hesitations, things like that.
You say that whenever a new and exciting actor bursts onto the scene, that it's often said of them that they have this amazing sense of naturalism or realism. And I wanted to talk about that because you write about what I find to be the really interesting case of the actor Edmund Kean, who acted in the early 19th century. And he was one of those actors that really lived a part. And you say that the older he got, the more, quote unquote, natural he got. And it got to be kind of absurd at some point. You know, he would really create his own kind of text at times.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there is a temptation for actors on stage to have done the part for several nights, to feel they understand it. And then, if the play goes into a long run, they can begin to get bored with it. Long runs are very testing of actors because, you know, they are giving an idea of imaginative freshness when they may have been doing it 3 months, and freshness is the last thing they feel. And sometimes they begin to think, well, I could add a few lines here or there, or I could do an improv. And of course, actors in the last 60, 70 years have fallen upon improvisation as a wonderful rehearsal tool, so that you know the text, but you will do a scene with someone, whether your two characters are talking about something completely different, not in the play, but something that enriches their sense of the characters and makes them better when they get to the real text on stage.
It's interesting. I wonder what you thought of the film Birdman, because it's very much about those moments of excess. It's very much about acting. I mean, did this? I'm guessing Birdman, did it come out after you wrote the book?
Yeah, it did.
I had finished the book.
Yeah, I could easily have used it if the timetables had been a bit different. Yeah, it's a very interesting portrait of a theatrical company and a production, and I think it's true to something that most people in the theater and in film would agree to, that making it up, rehearsing it, getting ready to do it, is a chaotic procedure. And you reach a point where you don't trust the play, you don't trust the script. People are rewriting the script all the time. You don't know how the bits you're doing really will fit together, particularly in film, where you will have to do a 10-second scene, and you ask the director, well, where is this? And he says, well, it's just before the end, except that I have a thought I might put it much nearer the beginning. So the whole shape and flow of the performance seems very crazy. And, you know, I think that can make actors respond in a similar way. And it's one reason why the general population think that professional actors are on the edge of craziness. They may be consumed by the part. There are plenty of stories about actors who really became their part and had serious difficulty getting out of it.
You know, there's this famously apocryphal story about Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman while they were shooting that dentist scene from Marathon Man. And
yes,
as the story goes, Hoffman had stayed up all night or several nights. I'm not sure. You know, it depends on which version you hear, because he wanted to make his exhaustion in this scene look real. And Olivier is said to have asked him, "What, you know, why do you look so tired?" And Hoffman said, "You know, I've been up all night." And Olivier replied, "Why not try acting? It's much easier."
Yeah. Well, that is a portrait in brief of the big difference that has existed for a long time between American and British acting.
Yeah.
Dustin Hoffman was a method actor, Actor's Studio. And he believed that you had to find a part of yourself in the character and build from there and invest it with your own sense memories and so forth. And that can be quite a slowing process because the actor needs to get into the spirit of it, so to speak. And on Marathon Man, that was delaying the film.
Right.
And Olivier, by contrast, acted as if, behaved as if he was simply a professional, a brilliant professional, but someone who loved pretending, had been trained in it from childhood, and came on the set and did his act. And, you know, the two actors were working in a very different set of rhythms, and that's something that can be quite difficult in a production. It almost means the director has to talk to the people individually because bringing them together is very difficult to find a shared ground. And Olivier said, yeah, why doesn't he try acting? Now, knowing Olivier a bit, I think he said it not really very sympathetically. Olivier was a very competitive man, and I think he said it to goose Hoffman and to needle him a bit, which I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
And that may have helped the show. That may have made them more antagonistic because those two characters really need to hate each other.
Yeah, they do.
And when actors work together, it's sometimes hard for them to do that if they become friendly.
You point out in the book, Olivier, as you say, was skeptical of the method acting. He said that American theater had kind of misapplied it and that it was too much, this is how he said it, an all-consuming passion for reality. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think what he meant was that method actors work very hard to make us feel that we're not seeing an actor, but we're seeing a real person. And Olivier, on the other hand, was raised and believed the notion that when we watch a play or a film, we are watching both the character and the actor. We love to feel that he or she is pretending and to watch how they are doing it. I think this is a key to our pleasure with actors. Personally, I don't buy the idea that we think we're seeing a real person.
Right.
I think we're seeing a superb act of pretending. And I think that's essential to why acting matters.
It's so interesting. Ilya Kazan had his own observations about Laurence Olivier's process when he directed him. And he was kind of, like on some level, it seemed like he was disdainful of the fact that Olivier, like a lot of the British actors, were, as he saw it, kind of, they had this kind of surface preparation, which is they developed a kind of technique about what's the, you know, what's the way they walk and what's the way they talk. Yeah. And they worked.
And Olivier often began with a false nose.
Right.
He loved getting a different nose for every part. And he sometimes said, I think he was teasing, but he said, once you've got the nose, the rest follows, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that, again, was his competitiveness. People in America were in awe of him, but did not really like him. And Kazan is certainly a very important figure in the whole movement that began to turn against English actors and think they were just too good to be true, and that they were overtrained, and that they didn't get to the heart of reality. And I think that impetus is really what's behind the Method and the Actor's Studio. And that was a hugely important, influential trend in acting. And, it, you know, it's a kind of acting that means Montgomery Clift, mm-hmm. Marlon Brando, James Dean, Rod Steiger, Geraldine Page, and it's unquestionably been a great movement, and I think it's brought something to actors. But sometimes an actor can get so caught up that things break down. I tell a story in the book about Daniel Day-Lewis, an English actor, but very much a method actor, and he was playing Hamlet at the National Theatre, which was a enormous test, and
This is Richard Eyre, by the way, directing.
He directed it. Yes. And Day-Lewis, like a method actor, believed he had to find something in the part that he knew from his own life. Well, he saw that Hamlet was in grief over the death of his father. And although Day-Lewis's father had died maybe 15 years earlier, Day-Lewis had never really dealt with it, I think. He'd never reconciled himself to it. So he still missed his father very badly. And he got so caught up in this connection that other people on the show could see that he was in a sort of perilous state. He would shudder sometimes on stage when he was playing the part. And one night, he actually came to a halt. And the other actors looked at him for a moment thinking, oh, Dan's doing one of his great pauses. He'll carry on. Yeah. But he didn't carry on. He started to weep, and he walked off the stage. And the show had to be halted for 15 minutes before the understudy came on. And here's the thing that's most remarkable. This was 1989, I think.
Yeah.
Well, in the years since, Day-Lewis has done fabulous things in movies. He never went back on the stage after that night.
Richard Eyre explained that it's funny you say that. In some ways, Eyre thought maybe it's my fault as the director, because Richard Eyre explained that Daniel Day-Lewis's problem wasn't so much with his relationship with the ghost, but his relationship with the play.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, Hamlet isn't simple stuff. Almost everything is in Hamlet. It's a very long play. It's really draining for an actor. And Day-Lewis had worked very, very hard at it. And I'm sure, like most actors, there were nights when he thought he'd got it, and then other nights when he just felt ghastly because he hadn't got it. And when that play opened, it got bad reviews.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't matter how good and famous an actor you are, bad reviews can be devastating. And I think all of that contributed to what you'd have to call his breakdown on stage. But, as I say, he's never been back on stage mm-hmm. since. Now, clearly, he could. He has the ability. But there's something about live performance, I think, that has come to frighten him. And, of course, that gets into the whole matter of stage fright.
Yeah, of course.
It's hard to think that people who've been acting 50 years have stage fright, but occasionally they do, and it's unaccountable, it's irrational. It's what you or I would feel if we had to go on one night with a live audience. We'd be terrified.
Yeah.
Actors are not terrified that often, but then suddenly, sometimes, they are.
Well, there's always the recurring dream where a lot of us have the dream where we're naked or something at school or in business.
Yeah.
But actors have their version of that nightmare is that they've forgotten their lines. They're on stage and they completely
they'll dry up, or a door they have to open in the set won't open, or something like that.
Right.
And you know, it's a kind of constant paranoia that the thing you're trying to construct and pretend to will collapse in one way or another.
David Thompson, his book is called Why Acting Matters. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're considering the question, why acting on stage or in film, why it matters. What is the real, tangible value of it? The film critic David Thompson is our guest. His new book is an essay about acting. It's called Why Acting Matters. I love the way you write about Hamlet and the way Olivier saw Hamlet, because, of course, as you point out, Hamlet is a playwright. Hamlet is a director, and
oh, absolutely!
And
he hires the traveling players to put on a little play that will catch Claudius, his stepfather, and it works pretty well. And it's clear from those scenes that Hamlet loved acting. He saw at the end of the 16th century, Shakespeare saw, that acting was one of the most fascinating models for human experience, awareness, and judgment. And a lot of Shakespeare plays turn upon the way people act, the way they pretend to do something that is not really themselves.
I wanted to ask you about, there's another element to this Hamlet story with Daniel Day-Lewis. And we should point out, Judy Dench was Gertrude in that performance, which is...
I mean, this was the National Theater. Yeah. It was a very, very good cast.
Well,
the actor who came on as the understudy was Jeremy Northam, quite a well-known actor now.
Right.
And he got a standing ovation that night.
Gosh. But there's also, the story of Michael Bryant, which you tell later in the book. And you talk about how there are some actors who have these epiphanies about art and they're exuberant and they're passionate. But then there are others who kind of treat it like a matter, as you say, of carpentry or bookkeeping.
Yeah.
And Michael Bryant, on one hand, was like that. But he was there that night when Daniel Day-Lewis broke down. And
he
breaks down himself.
Polonius.
Later.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Judi Dench finds him on a staircase backstage, and he's sitting there sobbing. And it's because of what happened to Daniel Day-Lewis, a man he admired, I'm sure a man he regarded as a friend. And it was almost as if Bryant saw a man who would come back from being lost in the jungle and driven half crazy by it. And I think any actor knows that risk and that possibility. And Bryant was himself a brilliant actor, but not an actor who ever really talked about his process.
Right.
But he understood the crisis that had taken over Day-Lewis.
You know, when I think about the kind of journeyman actors who didn't talk too much about their process, I think about people like Spencer Tracy.
Yes.
He hated to talk about process.
Absolutely.
He disdained
and
the
I
idea
think,
of method.
And I think probably he couldn't have talked about it. You know, I mean, he's famous for saying things like, learn your lines, turn up, and don't bump into the furniture.
Right.
Well, that's one way of putting it. Other people who love Tracy know that the point, one of the points of his films is just to watch what's going on behind his eyes. Now, it was brilliant, and there are a lot of screen actors like that.
Yeah.
Gary Cooper is like that.
Sure.
But I seriously doubt whether Cooper or Tracy could have sat down and explained the process to you. There is a matter of instinct in it.
Mm-hmm.
And even Olivier, there's a story in the book where Olivier is playing Othello, one of his great parts, and it's been a huge success as a production, but one night, everyone on stage realizes that they're watching a special magic.
Right.
Something extra has come to inspire the performance. And after the show, some actors come up to Olivier in his dressing room, and they say, Larry, there was something unique tonight. Did you feel it? And he said, I did. But I don't know what it was, so I don't know how I do it again.
Yeah. Well, isn't that the truth? I mean, when you capture that magic, it's ineffable. You can't. You may never get at it again, and isn't that great though?
Oh, superb!
Yeah.
And obviously, it's one of the things that makes actors keep on doing it because they live in hope of this epiphany, this moment where they will transcend every other performance they've given. And yes, it's a constant inspiration.
You write about Marlon Brando. He was, of course, very, very much a method actor. And you talk about the difference between Brando and Olivier, for example. Whereas Brando, as you say, yielded to contempt, sort of moved over into self-loathing. Olivier didn't.
No. Brando, I think, beyond dispute, was a great actor. He'd done it on stage. He did it on screen for about half a dozen movies. And then something happened. And he fell out of love with acting.
Yeah.
And he eventually began to despise himself for doing it, for pretending, for lying. He called it lying. He taught a course near the end of his life where he was really attacking acting because he said it's just a pack of lies. And, you know, he worked less and less. He got terribly out of shape. So that he was very restricted in the kinds of parts he could play. But in Britain, there is a tradition, and Olivier is one example of it, John Gielgud even more so, that actors act. They keep in work. The thing they most fear is resting, not having a part. And in Britain, that means actors will work on film, on stage, on television, on radio even. John Gielgud did some fantastic radio plays. And Gielgud was acting into his 90s. And you know, there was nothing else he knew or wanted to do. And Olivier had bad health at the end of his life, and that rather restricted him. But he kept coming back from illness to do something. And often the things he came back for were pretty bad films.
Yeah.
But he could not stop it.
Yeah, like the jazz singer.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's a good example.
Not so good.
The Betsy. The Betsy yeah. is another yeah. one. Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
There's a great...
But he was shameless. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he knew that some of this work was not very good, but he just loved to keep in work.
I love the story you tell about Jean Gielgud getting this sword from somebody.
Yes.
And somebody said it was Henry Irving, the great actor's sword. And so Irving passing it down to Gielgud, he liked that idea. And then he passes it on like this baton to Olivier. And you say the culture of acting needs the sword.
Well, it's a talisman.
Yeah.
No one really knows whether the sword has provenance, whether it did belong to Irving or Keane. There are different stories about it. But it's an old sword, and it's like a magical scepter. And Gielgud got it in the 30s. Someone gave it to him because his Hamlet had been so great. We have no record of his Hamlet, but it was such a great performance. He got it. And then later on, Olivier did his Hamlet, and Gielgud, with great generosity, presented the sword to Olivier. And you know, it was sort of assuming that there could be a process of succession.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Olivier gets to be an old man, and his wife, Joan Plowright, the actress, says to him one day, "Larry, don't you think it might be nice if you gave the sword to one of the young Hamlets of today?" And Olivier says, "No, it's mine."
I think there was a different... I mean, the competition that you sense between Olivier... Well, he was very competitive, as you said.
Very,
You had a sense, though, that Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson, it didn't seem as competitive with them. They had a kind of an affection for each other, it seems.
I agree, and I think that they would act in nearly anything if it just got them out of the house and acting. They loved it, and there was not the same ego, I think, in them. But you know, something else has to be said for Olivier. He was clearly a great actor, many performances that are just outstanding. But in addition to all that, he is the man who insisted that the old ideas for a national theatre in Britain should come into being. And he was the first director of the National Theatre before the theatre was even built. That meant attending lots of meetings, being very political, dealing with people. And he brought that theatre into being. And it now has an amazing record. And it's something I think that most American tourists going to London say, "I've got to see something at the National."
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a real shrine to acting. And on the whole, it produces very good productions, very good performances. And he did that.
Yeah. There are a couple of questions that have come via email I wanted to ask you about. Donnie in Midvale wonders what I think so many of us do, and that is, why is it that a lot of the great actors have British accents? You know, why are the British so good at this?
It's a fascinating question, and I would have said once, and I think it certainly affects the generation of Richardson, Olivier, and Gielgud. England then was a very secretive country. It was a country that believed deeply in not showing your feelings too much, in repressing them, and putting a stiff upper lip and a brave face on everything, not showing the real vulnerability you felt. But the vulnerability was there, and I think the very repression encourage some people to dig into that area and to voice it. The English actors from the beginning of the movies, really, but particularly when Torque came in, were very, very much in demand in America. And that's another thing that alienated a lot of American actors and people in the theater. They loathed this English voice. You take an actor like John Barrymore, I think a very considerable actor. Now, he was American, but he sounded English.
Right.
And, you know, there was a generation or two of American actors who thought you had to sound English, particularly if you were doing Shakespeare. And even now, it's amazing to see how many actors born and trained in Britain are playing American parts and doing the American voice so that no one really notices. Now, American actors have much more problem with that when they go to England. It's much harder for them to put on another accent. The very thing that has been trained and taught to British actors.
David Thompson, his book is called Why Acting Matters. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with film critic David Thompson. We're talking about his book, Why Acting Matters. There's a question from Rosal in Provo. Just going back to that Daniel Day-Lewis Hamlet performance, Rosal had read about the thing that sort of freaked Daniel Day-Lewis out is that he had actually seen his father's ghost. And there's some apocryphal parts about this kind of story. Daniel Day-Lewis himself originally said, yes, I saw my father's apparition. But then he kind of went back on that, didn't he?
Yeah, well, you know, it became a celebrated incident. I don't know if anyone at the National Theatre has ever walked off the stage playing a lead part before or since. Right. So it got huge attention. And I think he felt he had to say something at the time. And he said he had literally seen his own father in the form of Hamlet's father. And later on, years later, he backed off on that and said, no, he had said that, he thought, because he was so disturbed, so moved, and so caught up in the thing. You don't know which story is true.
Right.
We all do extraordinary things one moment. And years later, we tell other people and we tell ourselves, no, it wasn't quite like that. It was a foolish moment. But no, we didn't lose control. And no one knows the answer. And probably Day-Lewis no longer knows the answer because it's a story that has been told so many times. I tell the story in the book and I tell it as well as I can, researching what people said. But you know, when I was writing the passage, the whole process of pretending got so strong that I thought, did I see that performance? I didn't see it. I didn't see it. And I think, you know, it's the human habit to think that we probably or possibly were there at a great moment. So certain sporting incidents seem to have been seen by five times the number of people who could have gotten into the stadium.
There's a you write about James Dean. Of course, he died young, so we weren't ever able to see what his potential could have been. But this is interesting. You say in the film Giant, that exposed his limits as a technical actor because he struggled to really look like an older man, which he had to play in that film.
Yeah. There's a passage of time, I don't know, 20 years or so. And he becomes a very successful oil tycoon when he was a kid who one day found oil on his scrap of land. And I think he put gray in his hair. He had makeup. And I think he did his best. But he was still a very young man. And he had not really been trained to that kind of calculated pretending. And I don't think he's very good in the film, certainly not compared with how he is as the kid.
Yeah.
As the kid, it's in line with his two other big performances in East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause. But of course, Dean could be alive now. He'd be a very old man.
Sure.
And probably the story of his career would have ups and downs, but a good deal of sadness. But the fact that Dean died suddenly, tragically, after just three films, had a lot to do, I think, with the way people fell in love with him right afterwards.
Yeah, and then, of course, you compare Brando's performance of an older man, of Vito Corleone. And, he wasn't even 50 when he played that role.
I know. And that is a brilliant impersonation of an imagined person. And, it shows a change in Brando. The guy who had wanted to be his true self became a great pretender later on. And he put on makeup, he put on different clothes, different accents. He became enamored of all those deceptive ploys in acting.
I want to ask you about a story you tell early on in the book. I guess it must be your first experience seeing Olivier on stage.
Absolutely.
You're 16 years old. And you go see him in The Entertainer. It's about Olivier plays this music hall comedian named Archie Rice.
Yeah.
And you even tell the backstory how Olivier challenges, I guess is the right word,
right,
John Osborne, write me a role.
That's right, because Look Back in Anger, Osborne's first performed play, had a very big impact. And it was said to be a new angry young man generation. And in conversation one day, Olivier said, well, why don't you write a part for me? Thinking, oh, Osborne will never be able to do that. But Osborne rose to the challenge and created this character, Archie Rice. And it was the first play I went to see on my own. In other words, not taken by my parents. And I was sitting in the front row of what's called the gallery, the balcony in England, in a small theater. And there are moments in the play where Archie steps out of his sort of normal life and comes forward to the footlights and does the comedy act that Archie Rice would do in a musical. And when he did that, by luck, because I was on the right side of the theater, I probably wasn't more than 25 feet from him. I cannot remember the play. I don't know whether it's a good play or a bad play. But I still remember being riveted by this idea that this man is putting on an immense act for me, and I can't take my eyes off it. It was a very important moment for me in my sort of education about acting.
In the book, you explore what it means to actually be entertained. This question of whether it's a diversion or is it something more meaningful? And this is how you put it. You say, is it a matter of having time passed or having time filled?
Yes. Well, people use the word entertainment to suggest something light, frivolous, not art, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's possible for human beings to be really entertained, to be caught up in what they're watching, to be moved by it, delighted by it. I don't think that happens without a process of identification that is actually just like watching an actor do Hamlet, or watching a great soccer player out on the field doing amazing things.
Let me ask you finally, you sort of push back on the idea of whether or not a performance can help you in life, can make life better. But I wonder, in the sum of things, and we only have about a minute left, so maybe this isn't a fair question with a limited amount of time, but what has acting, if you think about it, I mean, I guess this is what the essay is about, but has it made you deeper as a person? What has it done for your life? That's a big question.
Well, that's for other people to judge. I will say this, though. I think watching actors and falling in love with them has shown me that there is a thing that we could call depth in human personality, and that to explore it is a lifelong fascination. So I think, in a funny way, I became a writer because of the inspiration of actors. I saw what fiction was, really, more than in reading books, even in the pretending of a great performance. I saw what fiction could be.
It's David Thompson. His book is Why Acting Matters. He joined us from the studio of NPR station KQED in San Francisco. David Thompson, thank you for the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Bob Nelson. Our thanks to Braden Child. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.